You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, mulling over some of the construction industry news from the past 2 weeks. April already, Phil. I can't believe it.
It whizzes by, never stops.
Easter's already come and gone. Still feels like February down here.
How many Easter eggs did you eat?
I haven't eaten any yet, but I did get one.
Oh,
a friend gave me an Easter egg. First one I've had for years.
They're a lot
smaller now, though.
Yes, I didn't get any, but I gather they're more expensive than half the size. Shrinkflation.
About the size of a goose egg. I was very disappointed. Well, I shouldn't be disappointed. As I say, I haven't had one for years. But anyway, that's Easter done and dusted. We can look forward to summer, if only it would cheer up a little bit weather-wise. Anyway, Phil, what's happened over the last couple of weeks? There's some interesting crane stories around. I think we're going to discuss some of those.
I would like to talk about mobile cranes. This is a story which has sort of been rumbling. Various people in the world of mobile cranes have been bringing to my attention that there's a story to be written. And I've never really had a specific news peg for it until finally something came in from a consultancy called Pride Safety, based in the Midlands somewhere, flagging up the fact that basically, it seems, in large parts of England and Wales, no cranes will be able to operate for the 5 days over Easter, certainly four, some cases 5 days over Easter. The police are saying, no, your mobile cranes, they're a nuisance, they cause congestion, be off with you, we're not having it. And this is kind of the culmination, as I say, it's been going on for ages. Now, I looked it up. I'm aware that there are rules for heavy vehicles on the roads, and I'm aware of something called STGO, which is something like special transport general orders or whatever.
So special types, I think.
I'm going to flag up straight away that I'm a layman on these things. The regulations are incredibly complicated about what you need to do. And listeners in the crane industry will go, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, I'm going to tell you that before I start. I don't know what I'm talking about, but here's what I've tried to find out and glean. So I think I've got the big picture correct in what I'm saying, if not the fine detail. What I do know is that there are complicated regulations about what sorts of vehicles, including construction machinery and including mobile cranes, can go on the road. Mm-hmm. Now, as a result of this, the people who run and manage mobile crane hire companies are all over. They're all on top of the fine print of what they need to do. And so are the crane manufacturers. And even though we've got different regs from the European Union and rest of Europe, mm-hmm. I'm pausing so much for my dog to stop barking.
How do you know he's going to?
And there he is. I can hear him in the background.
Let him carry on.
I can hear him in the background. The crane hire companies, they purchase their equipment based on what the rules say. So they've invested gazillions of pounds to comply with UK traffic laws or road going laws. And if someone turns around and says the laws have changed, suddenly they're going, hang on a minute, does that mean that this crane no longer works as a piece of business kit? I mean, it still lifts, but I can no longer operate it. So it's quite important that they keep tabs. Anyway, what the police apparently have been doing in a lot of places, and it seems to be led by the West Midlands Police Force, and they've got this thing called Operation Night Stare. It's been going on for a while now. At least a couple of years, I think. Clamping down on the movement of heavy loads at certain times. And it has spread to lots and lots of other police forces around the country, 10 or so regions, Thames Valley, North Wales, Norfolk and Suffolk, etc. And they're now saying you cannot drive on the roads between, essentially in rush hour. But rush hour, is, as we know, is not an hour. It might be between 7:30 and 9:30 in the morning and, you know, 3:30 and 6:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And the actual, those periods might vary from place to place. And the point is, if you're driving a mobile crane to a job, you generally want to be on site, set up and ready to go probably at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning. But you can't. You're going to have to, you know, get up at 3 in the morning, get there at 5, find somewhere to park where you're not allowed to and hover. And I mean, the logistics become difficult. And I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. But let's, first of all, there have always been, as part of the rules that the crane hire companies know about, for big loads, and I had a look at the government website this morning about the rules, it says that mobile cranes with a gross weight of more than 80 tons, or between 80 tons and 150 tons, they've got to give 2 days' notice to the police and 5 days' notice to the highways authority in case any, mm-hmm. you know, bridges can't cope and you not yeah. make sure you're not going over anything that's going to collapse. And this is all good stuff. If you've got, you know, a 150-ton load going down the road, it needs to be properly planned, and it generally is properly planned.
Yeah.
But anything under 80 tons is just a regular mobile crane. It does not have to give special notice. All sorts of other rules you've got to observe, but you're allowed to use them. You're allowed to run them on the road, according to the government. So I had a look. Okay. How big is a crane that weighs 80 tons? Things, when we talk about mobile cranes, anyone talks about mobile cranes, yeah. when you talk about an 80-tonner, it doesn't weigh 80 tons. That's its theoretical maximum safe working load. And it never will lift 80 tons, an 80-tonner. It just means that it's a number, it suggests its category size. Most of the time, it's probably lifting, I don't know, a ton at 30-meter radius, 20-meter radius maybe, 30-meter boom out, whatever. I mean, I'm sure there's numbers are wrong, but the point is it's when you're stretching out and leaning that you're never going to use your crane at maximum full capacity because it's useless lifting right next to the base of the crane.
It's something like 3 meters radius, which is 80 tons at 3 meters radius, or something like that. Yeah.
Anyway, this 80 ton cutoff point at which you've got to give 2 days' notice to the police. I had a little look at what cranes weigh, and I just looked at Lee Pears 200 tonner, five axle 200 tonner, that weighs 60 tons. So that's well under. You probably, you know, you can put 20 tons of counterweight on that and travel and you'll still be fine.
Yeah.
It's seven axle 400 tonner, that weighs 84 tons. So that's over.
Yeah.
But 400 ton crane, 400 ton safe working load, rated capacity, is a pretty big and unusual beast.
That's
not your run-of-the-mill crane. 200 tons is not your run-of-the-mill crane. Your run-of-the-mill day-to-day crane that you'll see on the road, it's probably, you know, it might be a five-axle 100-tonner. More likely it'll be a three-axle, you know, Lee Pears 60-tonner, weighs 36 tons.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is not an especially heavy machine. It's something like that, a 60-tonner, weighing 36 tons. It's got all-wheel steer.
Yeah.
Can turn on the sixpence, highly mobile. They're not going to go fast. They probably can go fast, but they're not allowed to go fast. So they're only going at 30, 40 miles an hour or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally not a problem. The police, however, have decided it's a problem. Get off our roads during... Yeah. rush hours. So in these rush hours, if you add them up, it can work out at, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. So far, talking to one crane hire guy, he was saying so far they've had lots of notification from the police that this is no longer allowed and you're not allowed to do this and you're not allowed on these roads and to do that, this, that and the other. And they've gone back to police saying, hang on a minute, this is what the law says. What's going on here? Yeah. And the police are basically saying, we are the law. We decide, regardless of what the legislation says. So there's no democratic accountability here. There's no, it's just like completely anti-business.
Yeah.
And they're just deciding what trains can and can't run, where and when, or in fact, none of them can run. The point is that up to now, they seem to have got away with slaps on the wrist, but that it is the suggestion is, the word on the street is, they're about to start impounding. There might have been a couple of cases of cranes being impounded by the police, but they're going to start getting heavy on it. And it's just going to get harder and harder. This means two things. One, if you want to hire a crane for a simple lifting a air conditioning unit onto the top of a one-story industrial building or something, you're probably going to have to pay 2 days crane hire for that job instead of 1 day or half a day. You're going to have to pay.
Because you can't arrive, do the lift and leave on the same day.
Correct.
Yeah. So
that's probably going to happen. Second thing is, the second thing is probably a lot of crane hire come and say, sod this for a game of soldiers. I'm getting out of this game because it's just can't make it work. But the third thing I predict, I dare say it already happens. I'm not naming any names, but the opportunity for police to have swathes of brown envelopes in their back pockets. It's just a recipe for, if the police have come down to business and say, you can't operate this business, in order to stay in business and keep employing people,
we're going to
end up doing what the other nations of the world do.
That was close.
We're going to have to oil the wheels of commerce as well as oil the wheels of the cranes. It's just a recipe for bungs.
I just don't understand the logic behind it, because, you mentioned earlier that this is about, keeping large and unwieldy vehicles off the roads during rush hour. But one of your stories, and in fact, the story which you dropped, I think, on Thursday, was that basically nobody could move a crane over the Easter weekend. We're talking about bank holidays, because I think the Met Police, you said that weekends and on bank holidays, cranes cannot move in London between 10:30 a.m. and 8 p.m. Which, what's that got to do with, rush hour? Nobody's at work then, it's, the roads are empty. I mean, most people are down here in Devon on a bank holiday. So why can't you move a crane through central London on Easter bank holiday?
Because PC Plod wants a brown envelope.
Well, I think that's probably it. Yeah, it's crazy. Doesn't make sense at all. And as you say, most of the cranes, the majority of the cranes which you see, and you do see them trundling up and down the motorways, generally speaking, they're small 2-3 axle jobs and well within the weight restrictions. I think there's an axle weight loading limit, isn't there, of 12 tons, something like that.
If only. For most of Europe, for the European Union and that 12 ton per axle weight limit is the guide for the German crane manufacturers and therefore all the mobile crane manufacturers. It used to be Krupp, who became Grove, Tadano Faun, Liebherr, and Demag. And Demag became Terex, and then they're now part of Tadano. So you've basically got Tadano, Grove, and Liebherr making mobile cranes in Germany. These all-terrain mobile cranes, or other types. And their basic guiding principle is, we design our cranes to travel at 12 ton or under 12 ton per axle weight.
Per axle,
And you take extra counterweight on a separate truck that travels behind, and you can add counterweight to it to make the crane stronger when you get on site. UK doesn't do this because it likes to do things different. This is way pre-Brexit. It's nothing to do with Brexit. It was decided that it was never a European Union thing. And it would be much simpler if the UK had just said, right, this works in, this is what the industry standard is worldwide, basically 12 ton per axle. And said, I think it might be 14 ton per axle. But as I said at the outset, it's more complicated than that. It's not as simple how many tons per axle. It's just,
I think it's even different for driven axles and non-driven axles, isn't it? There are all sorts of small print.
That's the fine detail I'm not on top of, but I know that we can drive more than 12 ton per axle, which basically means we have the UK companies get a 12 ton per axle crane and can drive with more counterweight on the back, so they don't have the same counterweight with a, so it can operate at, you know, with a different load chart.
Yeah, it's ironic really, because we talk about, you know, small mobile cranes, all-terrain cranes, truck cranes, things like that, as opposed to the contract lifting ones, the big heavy cranes, which generally speaking do need you know, special permission to be on the road. But at the smaller end, it's called, you know, we talk about taxi crane hire, don't we?
Exactly.
And the idea is that, you know, these are cranes that can go out in the morning. They can do one lift, say, in Basingstoke, and another one in Swindon, and be back in time for tea. So they can move from job to job, and it's very efficient and all the rest of it. But that'll all change if, you know, the police enforce these ridiculous rules and restrict the movement of these cranes. You know, you won't have a taxi crane anymore. It'll all be by prior arrangement, and it'll take twice as long.
And I think there's going to have to be cases where people will, the engineers who are planning jobs, on the basis that a taxi crane can turn up, do the job, push off, might have to rethink how they do things. And cranes have particularly grown in importance in the construction industry with the rise of prefabrication, of course, off-site construction, bigger and bigger pieces, and trains can just turn up and lift bigger and bigger loads more safely, more effectively. And the two things have driven each other by and large.
Yeah, that's true. You can't have volumetric buildings without something to lift the units up. You can't do it by hand.
Correct. Mm. So, yeah, I think got a note from, again, this Pride Safety Services, their lift planner, saying that they've talked to the council, but the council say it's a police issue. And, you know, we do have an annual meeting with the police and it might come up, but that's not till November. So basically nothing's going to happen. So the police do not seem to understand the difference between a modern crane and a huge notifiable abnormal load, such as a wide load or long load with escort. The police are impounding vehicles. No one will give us a straight answer as to why there are different rules for different police areas. We would ideally like to see cranes of 5 axles and below, which is certainly under the 80-ton operational weight we were talking about, that threshold.
Yeah.
5 axles and below, removed from the confines of the embargo. Embargo is a word that's being used to say you're not allowed the cranes on the road in rush hour at weekends and holidays, so that we can move at suitable times and continue to offer our clients the services they need, because increasingly they're not going to be able to offer their clients the services they need. It's a mess. It's a big issue, and I think the Road Haulage Association is on top of it. I think the Construction Plant Hire Association is starting to get on top of it. But as we've seen, I mean, I'll give you the Red Diesel as a case in point. Red Diesel. Farmers, you know, get away with it with being able to keep using it. Construction can't use it because the construction plant and hire lobby is simply not effective enough for whatever reason. I was in Berlin shortly before Christmas, middle of December, for a weekend break, and was witness to, couldn't get to the Brandenburg Gate because there was tractors everywhere, because they're about to have their Red Diesel rebate. You know,
they're losing it too.
They're losing it, but the farmers are losing it, or at least that was, I don't know if they're going to backtrack yet. And so all the tractors came in. And then for the first couple of months of this year, they were often in the papers, you'd see photos of Berlin particularly, tractors surrounding, huge great tractors surrounding the Reichstag. And I'm thinking, why don't all the mobile crane companies just drive into Westminster Square?
Yeah, that would be good.
Parliament Square, that'd be a good
photo opportunity. Yeah,
just get it all and stick 2 booms up to every. No, they shouldn't drive them there. Should drive them to, well, whatever the new equivalent of Scotland Yard is. I don't know where the Met Police live anymore, but new Scotland Yard was just off Parliament Square.
So they
could have perfectly sent a signal to the police, although it sounds like they should be going to West Midlands Police and sticking the booms up at this, I'm going to name him, PC Barry is the police lead for West Midlands Police, head of Operation Nightstir. He seems to be the lead stirrer in all of this.
Right, okay. Well, if he wants to put up a defence. He's welcome to contact us, isn't he? And we'll hear what he has to say. But I mean, presumably he's not alone. He might be the most enthusiastic when it comes to enforcing this sort of regulation. But as you say, it's not a legal requirement. It's something which the police have decided to enforce almost unilaterally.
Yes, I understand and accept that the police should have powers to say, if, for example, it's, I don't know, Notting Hill Carnival or the Lord's Mayor Parade or some big event or Olympic Open Ceremony, say, right, we're closing these roads, you're not allowed to do that. And, you know, in order to have a nice, peaceful, effective day out for everyone, we're going to have these special rules. But just to blanket say, that business model that's been operating with difficulty, but managing for decades, we don't like it anymore, so we're shutting it down.
Yeah.
They might as well say you're not allowed to eat ice creams anymore. We're banning ice cream vans.
Well, yeah, I think, yeah, it's just as logical. I mean, Crane Hire has come into line a bit with road haulage in recent years, hasn't it? But there was, back in the day, you know, you could drive a big, heavy mobile crane on just a normal driver's license. You didn't have to have any special qualifications. And I think, weren't mobile cranes exempt from vehicle excise duty as well? I don't know if they still are. But there were certain sort of let-outs, which was surprising when you've got an 80-ton crane and you can drive it on a car driving license and you don't have to, you don't have to pay road tax. But I think that loophole's been closed. Maybe they think they're closing another one.
I think it was the Road Vehicles Construction and Use Regulations 1986 is one of them. And no, this is the big one. STGO, Road Vehicles brackets, authorization of special types, close brackets, open brackets, general, close brackets, order. Road vehicles, authorization of special types, general,
right,
order,
yeah.
2003. So it's in 2003 that the regs change for mobile cranes.
Right, yeah.
And I think before that, they were kind of like, you know, tractors. You'll see, I don't know if you still do see, but you used to see sort of 14-year-old farmers' lads driving tractors at 5 miles an hour down the road. But I don't think you can do that now because some of these, you know, as you see on the Clarkson phone farming program, you get your Maserati or your Ferrari tractors or whatever that are huge and can go at, you know, 80 miles an hour. And
Oh, no, I don't know if it's different in Kent, but certainly we see farmers' boys still driving around in their tractors, big tractors as well, have to say. So, yeah, they still do it. Tractors, as you say, are different because I think...
But there must be a minimum age even for tractors, isn't there?
I don't know. I'm just thinking about one of my local farmers who actually rents a field directly opposite my house. His son has been reversing sheep trailers in and out of that for several years. And I think he's probably only about 22 years old now. So, it still happens. Yeah, there must be a minimum age. It's probably 17.
I was going to guess 16, but I'm out of date.
Somebody can correct us, I'm sure. But that was my understanding.
Anyway, I think, it's time for the mobile crane community to take some direct action.
Yeah. There's another crane story around over the last couple of weeks, which I think is absolutely astonishing. The big Chinese crane, Phil, you ran this story.
Chinese beast.
Yeah, and they call it an all-terrain crane, but my God, I'd like to see it come down my lane.
I'm not sure. I mean, okay, the definitions of cranes. Mobile generally means it's on rubber tires as opposed to crawler, but crawler cranes are mobile. They can move around a site. I mean, in general, we talk about mobile or all-terrain cranes, we mean it's on probably all-wheel steer with a telescopic boom. If it's got a lattice boom, it's probably not very mobile, and they're sort of a quirky, rare beast. But now, you could equally say that a lorry loader, a Hiab on the back of a truck, it's mobile and it's a crane.
Sure,
But that vocabulary or the, what's the word I'm looking for, the terminology of cranes it overlaps. But we're not talking about Hiabs here. We're talking about, but then there are truck cranes, which is a telescopic boom on a commercial truck chassis rather than a purpose-built carrier. But in general, when we're talking about, for most of the fleets of mobile crane hires, we're talking about, and they're almost all the German ones, it can move on the roads and off roads, it's all terrain. But as you say, when you get to a certain size, certainly, you know, 1,000-ton crane, and there certainly used to be a couple of these in the UK. I don't know if the people still got them anymore, but, you know, Ainscow and Baldwins have had them in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think you have to take the boom off the crane to actually drive it on the road. You've got to take it apart and then reassemble it when you get to site. So it's not exactly all terrain, and I don't think we cope with the heaviest of hills and muds and things. But but this Chinese crane you're talking about is a different thing altogether. It's got a rated capacity of 4,000 tons. So
it's crazy.
Basically four times the rated capacity of pretty much anything we've seen in the UK of its type, of a, you know, telescopic boom all wheel steer. It can lift 230 tons to a height of 170 meters. They say it's the biggest wheeled mobile crane ever built.
It's got a lot of wheels.
How many wheels has it got? It's got 11 axles. So it's got at least
22.
23, including the steering wheel.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
It's 11 axles. It's a huge, great thing. And inevitably, I mean, so much of these really, really big cranes are being made for one sector only, and that's wind turbines.
Yeah.
Wind turbines are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, higher and higher and higher. And the turbine people are going to crane people and saying, if we made this, could you assemble it? Could you make this work? Mm. If we do this, can you make it happen? Okay, well, go back, design a crane, whatever. And so it's a one-off at the moment, and it's being used for a wind farm in China, the Jing County Wind Farm for Hebei Rongcheng Technology. Excuse my Chinese accent.
Right.
In Hongshui. Yes, the XCA 4000. And it's ginormous. There's a video of it, folks, on the construction.
Go and have a look at the video, because it's astonishing.
Look for China unveils 4,000-ton capacity mobile crane. That's not very mobile, but at least it's more mobile than British mobile cranes, which are now officially immobile.
The thing about it is, I mean, with a mobile crane, let's continue to use the terminology all-terrain crane. As you say, that it means a crane which is on a wheeled chassis. The whole point is that most of the crane, you know, maybe not the counterweight, maybe not, you know, a particular hook block or something like that, can be carried to site on one vehicle.
Self-contained.
So self-contained. So in this case, it's got 11 axles, but basically everything is on it. But that's not even true. This crane, not even the telescopic boom can be carried on the tray, on the crane, only the base unit of it. If you look at the video, you can see people actually slotting one telescopic section inside another one. And they're massive. I mean, they're about sort of 4 or 5 meters in depth, these boom sections. And so basically you've got to transport this crane to site on a whole fleet of trucks. So every boom component, the jib, the hook, God knows how many trucks you need for the counterweight. And it's really only the winch and the base section of the boom comes to site on this 11 axle carrier. So I can't see the point, quite honestly. I mean, I would have thought that a lattice boom crane would have a higher capacity, because, you know, lattice booms are much lighter than telescopic booms. But maybe that's no longer the case. All the big heavy lifting cranes used to be lattice boom cranes, didn't they?
And I think by and large that's still the case.
Yeah.
If you look at the crane that Sarenz's big crane that big Carl at Hinkley Point C, for example.
Yeah.
And the big mammut things. The biggest ones. And they're often not mobile. They're on a ring platform.
Yes, that's
and
right.
They rotate on a circular track, a hoop.
Yeah. I mean, big Carl is, you know, makes this one look small, but.
I can't remember. What's big Carl's capacity? I can't remember.
I was going to ask you that. I can't remember. But it must be more than 4,000. Otherwise, they'll sell Big Carl and buy one of these. I can't remember what it was. Have a look.
I'm going to Google it. Bear with me, folks. 5,000 tons.
Yeah, but it can probably lift higher and it can probably lift out to a
yes, that greater as ever radius. When we talk about cranes being a, you know, it's notional yeah. safe working load.
Yeah.
One, they can probably actually lift more than that, but they have to have a safety margin and you don't want to risk it. Well, yeah. Germans do anyway. Maybe the Chinese ones don't have much of a safety margin. and two, you're never going to use it in that configuration. You're always going to want to, you know, full boom and at a radius.
Yeah. Even so, I would still urge listeners to go and find that video on the website because it is quite an impressive sight, no doubt about it. Quite a beast.
Enough of cranes.
Cranes, yes.
Talk to me about tunnelling, David. Tell me about the super sewer.
The super sewer. Well, funnily enough, you know, we talk about, you know, there's been a lot in the news recently about the water companies, particularly Thames Water, and the absolute mess they're making of all our rivers and watercourses and beaches, whereby, you know, pumping you know, thousands of gallons of shit into the rivers. And of course, Thames Water is as I say, probably the worst offender in many ways. Thames Water also in financial difficulty at the moment. But it's easy to forget that Thames Water is also behind the biggest tunnelling project currently in the UK, which is Thames Tideway, which is a massive scheme. I mean, it's a bit like it got underway just about as at the same time as the Crossrail project was coming to an end. You know, everybody was wowed by the tunnelling expertise of the people on Crossrail. And Tideway is not much less impressive than that. It's a huge super sewer underneath the Thames going right through the middle of London. And the whole idea is that it will increase capacity and it will prevent the need for sewer overflows. You know, in times of heavy rainfall, this is the problem at the moment, which is that these combined sewer outflows are tipping rainwater laced with raw sewage into the rivers. And the super sewer, the whole idea of the super sewer is it'll stop that. It'll increase capacity, take all this muck. Instead of tipping it into the river, it'll take it down to Beckton where there's a new treatment works and everything will be nice and clean. And the Oxford and Cambridge boat race will be able to take place without anybody getting gastroenteritis. And in fact, the news is that they've just finished the construction of the super sewer. When I say the construction, I mean the actual building work. So the tunnelling and, you know, the other infrastructure. That's over. And so all they've got to do is fit the wiring, basically, and get it running, up and running. So everybody's delighted that the super sewer is now completed, although it's not completed, as I say, that they've still got to do all the M&E work. And that may be where things will get difficult, because as we saw with Crossrail, everybody was celebrating the fact that Crossrail had finished construction works. And then, you know, the proverbial hit the fan. And when it came to putting in all the signalling and the power supplies and the rest of it, things suddenly ground to a halt. And the project was, I think, 2 years late as a result?
I can't remember how long it took for Crossrail, Queen Elizabeth Line. It's just the Elizabeth Line, isn't it? I can't remember how long it took from completion of tunnelling to opening to the public and you know, paying customers. But it was 2 or 3 years, wasn't it, or more?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, something like that.
But I would pretty sure that the finishing a sewer to opening it to paying turds is a lot easier. The commissioning process is, I mean, yes, I'm sure there's M&E. I'm not all that on the water treatment sector, but I'm sure there are, you know, controls and tech involved in it, even though it's just basically a big, long concrete tube. But it's supposed to, the tunnelling's just finished, sometime in 2025, it will start operating, coming on stream for real. That could be anything from January 2025, meaning, you know, whatever, 9 months away, to the end of 2025, meaning we've got, you know, a year and a half's worth of commissioning work. I asked the question, when in 2025, how long, you know, what are the potential risks for commissioning? Could it be, you know, presumably it's not going to be like Crossrail, but you know, are there any risks involved? And I didn't really get an answer to that question. They just said it will be fully complete in 2025.
Yeah.
It's due to be start. The system is due to start to be tested and commissioned later this year, and later this year will take away flows of polluting sewage into the tunnel to protect the river for the first time. It'll be fully complete next year sometime. But it does seem to have been. I think we said this about Crossrail. We're good at tunneling in this country. It's just the difficult bits we seem to, you know, come unstuck on, getting a train system up and running. And it does seem to have been, though, a pretty good, successful project. Beauty of it is it's inherently a green project. Everyone's going to support it and love it. It's doing something that is obviously needed, a good thing.
Yeah.
They seem to have held it to the original cost was it's going to cost Thames Water bill payers £25 each a year, and it's still going to be that, sort of. That's £25 at 2014 prices, which is now about whatever it is, £35 or more.
Probably.
But the actual, you know, in 2014 money, it's still £25 a year that they're paying. It demonstrated an innovative form of financing. This special purpose company was set up, Basil Jet Holdings, to raise the money and hold bonds and whatever for the project. I'm not entirely clear on what the sort of the whole risk reward setup is, but Thames Water have sort of been frozen out of the equation during it all. But it is going to be handed back to Thames Water, is my understanding, as soon as it's completed. But all in all, I mean, it was meant to open last year, and it's now going to be meant to be completed last year, open this year. So it has slipped, and they say 6 weeks of that is because of COVID. No particular explanation of what other slippage might have occurred. But on the whole, Andy Mitchell, the chief executive of Tideway, I think his knighthood is probably in the post.
Yeah, probably. I mean, obviously, Tideway, I can't remember where it starts in the west. I can't remember exactly. I know it ends in Beckton, but it's basically Greater London is the area it serves. And I'm just wondering what will happen further upstream, you know, in around Reading, Oxford, places like that, where they've had problems with the sewer, combined sewer outflows polluting the river there. Presumably, that will still happen. Unless Thames Water actually does something drastic. I mean, they say they're on top of the problem, don't they? But they want to charge their customers to actually pay for the cleaning up of the river. So I don't know whether or not that's going to make any difference.
I'm not all over Thames Water's capital works program. They might have already addressed it in that part of the country. I'm not sure, but I know they've got a heck of a lot that they need to do, and they haven't got the money to do it. And of course, it's, it's always going to be the customers that pay, because that's the only source of money there is.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I suppose it's half a cheer for Tideway. They've managed to do the tunnelling and finish that successfully. Now all they've got to do is, I don't know, put in all the sensors and the electrical stuff.
No, yabu to you.
Valve equipment.
I'm going to give no cheers to Thames Water, but three cheers to Thames Tideway.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
I think this is...
Yeah, certainly. The civil engineering has been great. And I've seen some fantastic photographs of some of the structures they've built there. It's astonishing.
Right, gosh, we've... Tempus fugit. Time's running away with us, David. I just want to give a quick discussion... Prefabs. We've talked about prefabs an awful lot, and I don't really want to rehearse all the previous discussions we've had on off-site construction, modern methods of construction. But big news broke before Easter that Top Hat, the one of the last startups standing, their mothballing their whizzy new robotic factory in Corby. Top Hat, they've got a factory in Dove Valley Park in near Derby in Derbyshire. It has capacity for 800 units a year. I don't think they've been operating at capacity, but it can make 800 units a year. They have built a new factory in Corby.
That wasn't that long ago. That was quite recently, wasn't it?
Well, it's not yet fitted out. They've got all the Wizzy robots on order, 50-something manufacturing robots, 59 manufacturing Cuckoo robots are on order, but not yet being delivered. And they've said, can you just put them in a packing case and leave them in a warehouse? We'll let you know if and when we need them. But this new factory is going to be able to have capacity to produce 4,000 units a year. So, you know, five times as big as what they've got. And they got new money from Persimmon invested in them, and new money from Aviva Capital Partners investing. They got a loan from you and me via Homes England. We, the taxpayer, had lent them some money. And last thing we knew, it was all supposed to start manufacturing modern homes at this factory this year. And they say, actually, do you know what? We're not going to do that yet. They say, we continue to believe that only, this is a quote from a Top Hat spokesperson, we continue to believe it'll only be through bringing volumetric factories of the scale of Corby on stream that the UK will be able to solve its long-term housing crisis. However, the short-term market conditions mean it's prudent to pause now, with the building almost complete but no equipment yet on site. We continue to develop our pipeline and will monitor conditions closely to restart when it is right to do so. So we don't know what that means, frankly. When is it right to do so? And they've laid off all the people who are working on the project there as well. So it's not like, you know, they're going to start again in 2 weeks' time. Rapidly on the back of this came a letter from the Housing Minister, Lee Rowley, to the House of Lords Built Environment Committee. Now, the last time you and I were talking about this topic, it was on the back of the House of Lords Built Environment Committee being out a report on the future of modern methods of construction, particularly volumetric house building, saying that the government strategy was in disarray, basically. And the Minister, Lee Rowley, is responded, as is the norm for the relevant minister to respond to parliamentary committee reports, either, you know, accepting three of your points but rebutting two, or this is what we're doing about it, and the typical stuff. He said, yeah, great report, thanks lads, sort of thing. We think MMC sector is great, it's had a number of successes. However, quote, it's also the case that the sector is facing challenges and there are clear questions which now need to be reviewed and answered in detail about where the sector currently is, where it is going, and what role the state will play in the future. He says, we all have the shared ambition of seeing MMC play a continuing role in the provisional of additional homes, but at the same time, there are clearly broader discussions to have about what can and what should be done in the future, given the changes the sector has experienced in recent months. Given the recent announcements of further industry exits, now bear in mind, Top Hat is not an industry exit, it's just on pause on its big factory. It comes into the same conversation. But we have had several industry exits, which we've talked about in the past. Given the recent announcements of further industry exits, I would like to give further detailed consideration to the development of MMC policy and how best this department can support the sector. And inevitably, that will take some time. Can I get back to you later? He says, I'll give you a more full answer when we've had a rethink of our policy. So what he's saying is, we stand by MMC, but we're reviewing policy. We're going to have a rethink about what our role should be in all of this. And I suspect he might be asking himself, should we be chucking good money after bad, or are we not chucking enough money at it?
Surely you don't think that they would chuck more money at it, would you? I mean, because it's been so noticeably unsuccessful. We had Ilka Homes, and another, you know, sort of bright light, you know, leading light in the MMC world. That's no longer. And now Top Hat is sort of moribund.
You know, Legal & General's gone. House by Urban Splash is gone. Modulus is in administration. Lighthouse has filed intent to appoint administration. Top Hat is not gone. We must be careful what we say.
No, it's not. But
it's not soaring through the sky like a golden eagle to save the world.
Well, no, absolutely. And, you know, the sort of the forward momentum has just ground to a halt. There isn't any. So, you know, I mean, we've talked about this so many times in the past, but MMC, everybody knows it's a great idea, you know? It's cheaper, it's safer, the quality is better, it's quicker, and, you know, what's not to like? But something's not to like because basically the market won't have it. And I think you've made the point in the past that it's basically that the business model is flawed, that you know, if you're going to make houses in a factory, you've got to have a pipeline of work and a reliable, predictable pipeline of work. And the British house building market isn't like that. It's up and down like a fiddler's elbow. So yeah, it's the model's broken. I think that's basically the problem, isn't it? It just, although it's a good idea, we can't make it work for some reason.
The only way to make it work is to have a state client. The reason why tunnelling projects, we've gone from Channel Tunnel to Jubilee Line to Crossrail to Thames Tideway is because essentially they are state controlled, assets. Sponsored. I mean, I know, you know, Tideway is a private sector project, but not entirely. It requires an overarching power to say, we'll do one big tunnelling project after the other and we can keep a tunnelling industry going. I mean, we now have HS2 tunnels great guns. We don't have sufficient public sector housing to support these factories. And that's what it requires.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think the fact that, you know, is it the big six or there are fewer now, maybe the big five house builders. They're private organizations. Their main priority is to make a profit and pay dividends to their shareholders.
They're brilliant at that. They do that.
Yeah, they're brilliant at that. But their raison d'etre is to provide housing for people to live in. And that's an important thing. It's a bit like, you know, tunneling. It's like infrastructure. It's an important national asset. Our housing stock. We've got the oldest housing stock in Europe. And basically the house building industry is in the hands of a few major private sector corporations. And, you know, and while that's the case, I think you're right. You know, we won't be able to make the offsite or volumetric or the modern methods of construction model work.
Yeah. So we've got the MMC. They're not called the MMC anymore. The MMC is now, you know, modern methods of construction. To me, it's the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. There's the MMC, Monopolies and Mergers Commission, the Office of Fair Trading. They're now the Office of, Competition Watchdog, CMA, Competition and Markets.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
And then they merged the OFT and the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. The CMA is, as we, I think we've discussed this, has certainly reported it. They are looking at investigating the house builders at the moment. So see what comes out there.
Yeah.
Right. Anything else from you, David?
I think that's about it. Nothing on my list of topics to discuss. I'm sure we could probably pick a few out of the air, but I think that's probably it for today, isn't it?
Well, I'll just tell people they might be interested. Well, I'm going to forward you an email I got this morning from, you know, H&H, the Breeze Block people.
Yes.
You get their monthly newsletter. And first thing caught my eye in light of RAC reinforced aerated concrete that we've talked about in the past. This is not RAC. This is just aircrete.
Yes.
They're saying, can aircrete stand the test of time? Read more. So I clicked on it. And if you click on that, it goes to the H&H website. And this is interesting. I think we should maybe do something in your magazine on this. They've just for fun, taken some 45-year-old aircrete blocks that have been at work, soaked them in water for 24 hours, drop them from high buildings, expose them to the elements, see what happens. And they're stronger now than they were designed to be when they were manufactured 45 years ago. So a nice little, for one of my concerns about a lot of these prefab housing and prefab buildings is their design life and their durability.
Yeah.
Well, Aircrete, they're showing here, passes the test of at least four decades.
I suppose it was inevitable, really, that H&H would do this, because I think probably the fact that their Aircrete blocks are basically made from the same stuff that rack panels are made of, but they're very different products and they're used in a very different way. Presumably they're finding that they're being tarred with the same brush as rack, and they need to, you know, have some sort of rear guard operation in order to make sure that people don't confuse the two.
Because they're used, well, not only have they not got the rotting iron in the middle of them, they're used in compression.
Yes.
Rather than, what's the opposite of compression?
Tension.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're much stronger in that, in compression. So, yeah. Oh, right. Well, I shall look out for that then. Phil, zap it over
another
to me.
Another material story.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Okay. Other than that, I'm sure there's something we promised people we'd talk about this week and we'd forgotten to do so. But do get in touch, folks. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. As usual, direct you to theconstructionindex.co.uk website for more on everything we've been talking about, including the video of that 4,000 ton Chinese mobile crane. I don't think the numbers stack on that. I don't think that's a viable business, that crane, but it's fun and interesting nonetheless, and you probably won't be able to get the parts, so don't go rushing out to buy one. But from David and I, that's all we've got. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.